Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, this state, California, and their work and their home here. This morning, we're continuing our new series, the third series now, one that will continue into the spring. I hope you will find it interesting. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute, and I'm a fellow in environmental politics at UC Berkeley. This morning, we have two guests, Glenda Drew and Jesse Drew. Good morning.
Good morning.
Drew and Jesse. Let me introduce you, please. It'll just take a minute. Glenda Drew is an associate professor of design at UC Davis. She explained to me that her work involves creating visual media projects, and these include layers of oral history, image and text, from 3D ViewMaster reels to scratch and sniff trading cards. May have to come back and ask you about this. And live cinema to documentary. She writes, her project is to create messages that contribute new ways of looking at history, culture, and meaning. The primary themes in Drew's work include visualizing the working class, food and labor, and the interplay of technology and culture. Jesse Drew is a professor of cinema and techno-cultural studies at the University of California in Davis. He's a documentary filmmaker, media artist, and writer whose work challenges the relationship between the public and mass media technologies. His work has been exhibited in a long list of places here, but they include the Mill Valley Film and Video Festival, the Film Arts Festival, the Worldwide Video Festival in Amsterdam, the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, American Indian Film and Video Festival, and many others. He's also has written a new book, which will be out soon, called A Social History of Contemporary Democratic Media. So again, welcome to the two of you. To what we want to talk about this morning is your film project, which you've tentatively titled Open Country, and it's about the current state of country music. Open Country, you tell me, takes a critical look at the representation of contemporary country music and seeks to reconnect this vital art form to its original roots in populism and workers' culture. But I should let you guys talk about that. So, good morning again, and I wonder if I can ask you, first of all, then, to tell me just a bit about yourselves and your work at the university, and how did you come into this kind of work, and maybe tell me just a bit about your teaching. Glenda?
Okay, well, I teach in the Department of Design at UC Davis, and the area that I teach is screen-based and interactive design. And so I have classes in motion graphics, website design, and other interactive projects. I also teach a history course on visual communications.
Okay.
So, Jesse, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah. I teach at UC Davis also, and I teach classes in documentary studies, documentary production, and I teach a class called Media Archaeology, which is a history of the technologies of media, going back to things like the telegraph and early radio all the way up to contemporary times. And I also teach a course called Electronics for Artists, and other sort of various classes in the vein of technocultural studies.
Well, it's always interesting to hear what's being taught, and it makes me think, what lucky students.
So I wanted to say something about how we got started on this project.
Sure.
So I got involved in working on media activist types of projects when I was in graduate school at San Francisco State, and joined Jesse in a group that he was very active working with at the time called Paper Tiger Television. And Paper Tiger Television is still very active in New York City and in other places sort of nationwide, I guess. And so Paper Tiger was doing, or we were doing with Paper Tiger, some media activist projects using video as a form to dispel myths about popular media. And so we just started working on video projects that were sort of tongue-in-cheek and kind of humorous, but taking very strong research-based positions about popular topics with media. And, you know, we did some projects around issues in San Francisco, and then we started working on a project looking critically at sort of Disneyification and just the way Disney kind of creates small environments that are supposed to represent, I don't know, in a way like a police state. And I don't know, that seems to have some connection here in what we're doing on this project, which is just looking more critically at the roots of country music and trying to reclaim it from the contemporary hold that Nashville has on the industry, and trying to create a richer understanding of the political roots and history, contributions, and potential of country music.
Well, let me start then. We're gonna come back to Open Country, the film project, but could you two help us with some definitions? I noticed the word alt country in one of the descriptions of your work. But beyond that, there's folk music, what we call traditional music, roots music. There's country music, the Nashville sound. Could you help us work through what some of this all is?
So it seems that there's many names for the type of music that have basis in really the root name being hillbilly, coming out of southern traditions of music making. And through like the early history, we see different names being used to describe this type of music, most commonly hillbilly, then folk. This was music that was not based in Nashville at the time, but through the kind of corporate interest getting involved in this music and becoming centralized in Nashville, we start to see the name country music become much more popular. And I don't think that any of those names, you know, are quantifiable, but still, you know, many of those names are used to describe the music still today. But country western has a particular meaning in our culture, and that certainly comes out of the, you know, 1950s and split that seems to happen between what was referred to as folk, hillbilly, and country, with folk music becoming, the name folk music being put more towards the left-wing working class and political lyrics, and country western being used for the music that was more popular and sort of mainstream. It coincides with McCarthyism, the split in that name.
Hmm. So I remember as a student, the first time I found out about this kind of music was clearly what we thought at the time was folk music, and we bought Vinyl's records on Folkways label, right? You've probably seen that. And as you say, it was often kind of traditional, but often left-wing. I mean, you know, it was what we left-wing kids in the 60s liked. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that, you know, our project, well, Jesse actually is the person who is doing more of the research on our project, and I'm the person more in charge of the visual design of it and some of the motion graphics that we're incorporating and all. But Jesse has written an interesting article on some of the topics that you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like a huge split we're talking about, Jesse. Is that right, or am I exaggerating?
Yeah, well, I think when you get to the naming, it's important to realize that there was no reason to name any of this music until the recording industry began. It's only then that they had to come up with a name for it, because before that, it was just music. And it was, you know, at the time, you know, the main sort of published form of music was out of Tin Pan Alley in New York City, and this other music was just music. And then pretty much the name that they came up with it was Hillbilly, because they needed to label it if it was going to, you know, start to appear on, you know, on radio stations and in music stores. So Hillbilly, old time was, and then folk was pretty much the genre. And it remains folk pretty much through the end of the 40s. And clearly with the beginning of McCarthyism is when you see this split. Now, if you look at the, you know, the kind of music that was popular, a lot of this music was interspersed with traditions of working class culture, you know, coal mining music, you know, music of itinerant hobos and ranch hands, you know, but also mixed in with what we would, you know, identify with, you know, classical kind of country themes, everything from, you know, girlfriends and bar fights and all that kind of stuff. When it gets into the 40s and McCarthyism, there is a clear effort to move the more political music out of the picture in much the same way that was happening in Hollywood. A lot of people are very familiar with the Hollywood 10 and what happened in terms of, you know, that kind of film culture.
No, I don't know if they are. Tell us.
Okay,
Jesse.
Well, you know, I mean, there were big blacklists, right? Many, particularly film writers, screenwriters, were banned from working in Hollywood, and because they wanted to sort of clean up Hollywood from a left-wing influence. And of course, we know some people went to jail. You know, people if they were tarnished with any association with any left-wing movements of the time, they were banned in from Hollywood. The same thing was going on in New York City in the television industry. A lot of people are not that familiar with that. But in the music industry, I think people are not aware of it that much. It was also happening in the music industry, particularly around people like Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and the Weavers. And so in the marketing trends, they want to isolate those people, which they sort of labeled folk musicians. And then this new industry is formed, the country music, which, you know, generally tends now and only now to be associated with Nashville. And so that's more of the sort of, you know, the music that's kind of been cleaned up from, you know, any sort of references to, you know, working class struggles or political issues. And that's kind of when you see that split. So the folk industry, the folk music scene at that point begins to drift more towards New York City, where it's reborn again in the early 60s. It's probably, you know, the trend that you were sort of talking about earlier, you know, that whole scene based, you know, mostly in Greenwich Village. And, you know, this country music scene begins to emerge and get stronger in Nashville.
Well, Jesse,
so
that's
kind of the split.
Yeah, so, but if we've got, say, Pete Seeger on one side, can you recall, what would be an example of something on the other side, the sort of McCarthyized music to follow?
Of the other side? Well, a classic example I like to use is Woody Guthrie and Hank Williams, both from the same part of the country. Both had a similar sort of, you know, a persona and a similar kind of style in a certain level. So, you know, Woody Guthrie was more singing about workers' rights. Hank Williams was more talking, you know, singing about other things. But both of them called themselves folk musicians. Now, Hank Williams considered himself and called himself a folk musician. But if you look at it now, if you say, well, who was Hank Williams, everyone would say, oh, well, he's like, you know, the guy, the godfather of country music. But there's very little difference, really, between a Woody Guthrie and a Hank Williams, other than their, you know, their strident, you know, politics. So what would be in a counterpoint to Pete Seeger? It's hard to say. You know, maybe someone like Merle Haggard, at least in the popular imagination. Although, you know, one of the things we're looking at is the politicization of country music itself, and we're sort of looking at that in the film, and you can see that though Nashville sort of likes to promote this conservative image, there's actually, you know, a lot of liberalism underneath there, particularly in the case of Merle Haggard, you know, who's, of course, well known by his Okie from Muskogee, which is sort of a classical right-wing kind of rag, but a lot of people don't realize that that song was written entirely tongue-in-cheek. You know, Merle Haggard is not that, you know, that conservative a person at all. Some of you might know that he was, you know, recently a very big supporter of Hillary Clinton, which probably, you know, irritated a lot of traditional country music fans to no end.
I think that's part of the premise of our project, is that this history is all much more complex than what, you know, appears on the surface. And Merle Haggard is a good figure to look at because, you know, he had his own history of, you know, being in juvie and then in prison for burglaries and beating people up, and has this resurgence or in prison where he then gets his GED and he meets Johnny Cash and decides that he's going to join the prison band. And the lyrics throughout his songs, I think, represent that, you know, very complex life and messaging that he, you know, has, from, you know, the fight inside of me to they're tearing the labor camps down. So it shows a kind of, you know, contradiction and complexity.
So what do you think, though, people were thinking? I once went to a concert outside, in a country outside of Youngstown, Ohio, to hear Merle Haggard, and it was a very interesting, very big, and very raucous crowd. And I have to tell you, they went nuts when he sang The Fight Inside of Me. Everybody was joining in. What happened?
Well, I think he, you know, at that particular time, right, that was a very contentious period of time in American history, you know, particularly, you know, the split over the Vietnam War, and the sort of, you know, the fights that raged between people who, you know, were, you know, defenders of the flag and defenders of the military, and, you know, the other side, which was like anti-war and very critical of the United States. And he certainly tapped into that anger. You know, actually, if you look at the lyrics of that song, they're actually not that unreasonable, although it taps into that anger. It basically says you can have your opinion, but if you start doing things like, you know, that are like aggressive towards these traditions, I'm going to get pissed off. You know, so, but you know, it definitely has that side of him. On the other hand, you know, Merle Haggard also sang a lot about the American working class, the plight of poor people, the plight of prisoners. So he was, you know, a mixed bag. He's no classic Republican by any sense of the imagination, by any sense of the word.
He also sang, was it Mama Tried?
Right.
And, yeah.
And that's something that I remember you talking about, a theme of about prison and prisoners and how, you know, people whose lives have gone wrong. And we don't hear that much about that subject in popular music anymore. Could you tell us what happened or a little bit about that, the Mama Tried?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like one of his songs that deals with being in prison, because he was in prison. I mean, he was the real deal. You know, singing songs about the plight of prisoners has a long tradition in country music and in the blues also. I mean, if you go back to Lead Belly, a lot of Lead Belly's tunes were eventually incorporated into country songs. So, you know, he sings, you know, I think the strength of country, I think that's why we like country, is because country is one of the music forms that really is based on, you know, average working people in the United States. And prison is certainly a big part of that life. It certainly is a threat to many people in the lower classes, particularly today, you know, when almost everybody, you know, at some point, if you're below, you know, a certain income level, you know somebody that's involved in the in system of incarceration. That to a higher degree than any other time in American history, it's ironic that on American, you know, pop country music channels today, I don't think you would hear any songs that deal with prison, with prisoners in that system. Where, you know, Merle Haggard sang about that a lot. And so, of course, did Johnny Cash. I mean, that's, you know, one of the reasons Johnny B. Cash became such a major country, you know, singing star is because of the series of concerts he did, both at San Quentin and at Folsom, not only singing about, you know, prison life, but singing them directly to prisoners themselves and trying to bring those people back into the fold of American life.
And there's a California connection there as well with both those guys, right?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, if you're talking about the history of country in California, Johnny Cash lived in California for many, many years. And certainly he made his career here. He really became a superstar in California, not only through his prison concerts, but because of his television show that, of course, came out of Los Angeles. I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but he had his own TV variety show.
Hmm. And California, again, you know, changing a bit here now. The great songs in this area that come to my mind, This Land, Pastures of Plenty, Deportee, totally California songs, right? Is there any continuity with that period of time with Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston? And what happened to that that tradition?
You mean just in terms of the early tradition of California and today, do you mean?
Yeah. Is anybody writing anything like Pastures of Plenty or Deportee or in this field?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can look at sort of, there are a lot of country music people today that still sort of write about California. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Jon Stewart's work or Dwight Yoakam. You know, who is, you know, from Southern California. I think California still looms very large. But I think also it's interesting to look at, if we're going to talk about the history of that in California, this goes way far back. I mean, back to, you know, you could say back to the Gold Rush days. People migrated to California from all over the United States, you know, looking for gold, and they brought a lot of their music traditions. A lot of the songs, popular songs of the day, were sung about going to California. And then early on, you know, towards like the teens and the 20s and the 30s, when you had, you know, a large amount of itinerant workers traveling around the United States, you know, the whole sort of hobo tradition, many of them were headed to California. Many of those songs were sung about California. One of the ones that comes to mind is Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was, you know, repopularized, you know, somewhat recently in the film A Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, that was a song by Haywire Mack, who, it was a traditional song re-recorded by Haywire Mack. That was one of the first big country hits on the radio. There's a very strong California tradition there. Haywire Mack was from California. I mean, he was based in San Francisco. And that song, you know, he was also a Wobbly, you know, an Industrial Worker of the World member. And, you know, that song is very much about this sort of California hobo tradition of coming out to, you know, the land of milk and honey, which for the most part signified California.
Do you remember, Jesse or Glenda? I think I heard you once recite a couple of the stanzas from that. Could you remind the
listeners? I have a good one to say. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the winds don't blow in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Yeah. This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. My guests this morning are Glenda Drew and Jesse Drew, and we're talking about the film they're working on called Open Country, and we're talking about country music. Before we leave this part of the discussion, let me ask you this. What about the Dixie Chicks? What happened there?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty common knowledge that the Dixie Chicks spoke out at a concert against George Bush and then had a big backlash, you know, from the country music industry against them, where their records were banned and their careers took a big hit from that. And they went on to make another really great song about that they're still mad and they're not saying sorry. So their careers were certainly affected because of the kind of corporate hold of on the music industry. But still, I think that they represent, you know, a strong voice of opposition that is also common in country music.
Well, they also are seen as, in some way or another, kind of a feminist voice. But, Glenda, you told me that's not the only time that there have been feminist sounds coming out of country music.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, one of my favorite examples is Loretta Lynn singing The Pill. And similar to the Dixie Chicks, many radio stations refused to play her song, The Pill. The Pill was written in 1960, and Loretta Lynn recorded it in 1972, but it wasn't, I think, released till 1975, and many radio stations refused to play it. At that time, any song by Loretta Lynn was pretty much guaranteed to be a top three, in the top three hits, and The Pill did not, you know, make it to that height, although it was an extremely popular song of hers, but it only made it to, I think, like number five because of the controversial subject matter. But I think that's another really great example of the complexity of country music that we're trying to uncover in our project.
Could you just say a word about that song? You know, probably a lot of people have never heard of it. Do you remember?
Yeah. I was just going to tell you some of the lyrics from it. Because,
oh, sure.
So that song, you know, at a very young age, Loretta Lynn was already the mother of six, and she had had like two children before she was even 19. And some of the lyrics from The Pill include, "All these years I've stayed at home while you had all your fun, and every year that's gone by, another baby's come. There's going to be some changes made right here on Nursery Hill. You've set this chicken your last time because now I've got the pill. This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little fancy frills. I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill." So it's, you know, a very positive song. And actually, I read that, you know, many rural doctors were really thankful for that song to spread the news about the availability of the pill. And there's a fun just visual connection for me also with another famous country singer, that's Jeannie C. Riley, who recorded Harper Valley PTA in 1960. And that song also uses the theme of miniskirt to express issues about women's rights and social hypocrisy. And some of the lyrics, do you mind if I say some of the lyrics from that song?
Sure.
So she's being targeted from her community for wearing short miniskirts and therefore not being a good enough mother. So the Harper Valley PTA writes her a letter saying, "Mrs. Johnson, you're wearing your dresses way too high. It's reported that you've been drinking and running around with men and going wild." And so Mrs. Johnson, Jeannie C. Riley, then attends the Harper Valley PTA meeting and says, "Well, there's Bobby Taylor sitting there, and seven times he's asked me for a date. Mrs. Taylor sure seems to use a lot of ice whenever he's away. And Mr. Baker, can you tell us why your secretary had to leave this town? And shouldn't Widow James be told to keep her window shades all pulled completely down?" So these songs, you know, were vehicles to talk about some really important social concerns.
Okay. Another question I have for you is this. The popular music, 60s music, at the end of the decade, kind of took a country turn. Dylan himself, I think. There were groups like the Flying Burrito Brothers, Creedence Clearwater. Jesse, what was going on there? What do you think was the, why did that happen, and what do you think was the significance of it? Was it a retreat from political engagement, or was it a reconnection with roots? What was going on?
Yeah, I think there was a strong reconnection with roots. I think there was this period of time when people were sort of, you know, purposely kind of breaking off from sort of, you know, basis of American tradition. And I think, like, I think in a lot of ways, similar to the spirit of this film we're working on, people felt the need to go back and sort of see what was there in that history. And I think people found a lot of things that they liked in that history. The whole sort of nature of, you know, populism and rich musical traditions, and also reconnecting with the lives of everyday people. So, yeah, you had, Bob Dylan going back and doing his Nashville Skyline. That was a big hit. But also you had, like, the Byrds and, like you said, the Flying Burrito Brothers. And there was a landmark album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? You saw a lot of reconnection to that in pop music. You know, also I should bring out Linda Ronstadt also, who was a huge singer, pop singer. She went and reconnected to her country roots, and she was considered one of the top country singers in the 70s. Many of her hit songs were number one on the country charts, and she was, ostensibly a pop singer. But many people reconnect, and I think always there's a reconnection. I think when people kind of get feel like they're drifting a little bit, like there's sort of the new thing is kind of going downhill, I think there's a lot of reconnection to go back. I think you can see that in punk music, too, in American punk music. You had a lot of punk musicians that were, more interested in emulating the London punk tradition. And I think by the end of that period, you saw, like, people like the Blasters, and you saw people going back and looking back in the roots of American music and finding a lot of things that they liked and a lot of similarities between early punk musicians. I've seen people mention Hank Williams as the original punk musician, because of his, like, lifestyle and the way he sang. Also, if you look at people like Wanda Jackson, there was a lot of sort of, punk aspects to her acts in the late 50s and early 60s. And then you have people like, Wanda Jackson, and people who had those roots are now working closely with, contemporary musicians. You saw that also with Loretta Lynn and the White Stripes recently. So I think that the musicians recognize how much rich, culture is in those roots of traditional folk and country in America.
So here's another question, though. When you mentioned the London sound, where earlier English sounds, the Beatles, especially the Northern rock bands, also the Stones, drew very heavily on American black music, blues in particular. And so did 1960s American pop music, but then that seems to have faded. I wanted to ask you, in following all of this, a little bit about the issue of race in music, and was it the end of the civil rights movement that played a part in this kind of a divergence, or what do you suppose was going on there?
Well, I certainly think that, race is totally weaved throughout this entire history of country, certainly. Even if you go back to the godfathers of country, people like Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams learned to play guitar from African-American men in their neighborhood. And many people would agree that country music, it white man's blues. It's clearly, a derivative of that. But you also have to, I think, when you're people who look back at the history of things, back in that particular time when this music was born, there were many cross influences that were going on. In a lot of ways, life was not as segregated then as it is today. A lot of early musicians will say that there was a lot of sort of, cross-pollination between musical forms, particularly in the South, between black and white musicians. That doesn't exist as much today, curiously. And certainly I think when you get to the late 60s and the 70s and you get that split, a real solid split between, the kind of, culture you're talking about, like the people who cheer on Merle Haggard and, Fight Inside of Me. Clearly, the whole, racism was a big part of that, of why country music became so identified as a white form of music. I think, clearly that's it's tied up in there. The whole, you lived through that period of time, you sort of, being sort of pro-war and, anti, black liberation kind of went hand in hand for many, cultures in America.
And there were all the, you reminded me, the great anti-war songs that came out of black popular music, Aretha Franklin's songs, and that just didn't seem to be happening elsewhere.
Or Marvin Gaye, What's Going On?
Marvin Gaye, right. War, the song War. Today, I don't know if this is in popular music. It seems like, and maybe it's not new, there's almost a kind of a musical apartheid in the country, in this country, the United States, in our culture. Is that an overstatement?
I think that's pretty accurate. We listen to a lot of that music, a lot of pop music in our house because we have young kids. Clearly there's such a divide between, a lot of the hip-hop, rap kind of stations and, other forms of music that's popular on the radio. But I think there's, the whole other layer that is interesting to look at, that is definitely one of the things we're looking at in the film, is who controls the culture industry. There's definitely, it's not like we're, freely exposed to all these sort of different genres of music, types of music. One of the things we look at in the film is who owns the radio stations in the United States. There's such a handful of media corporations that really, have a huge role in controlling the kind of music that, makes it into pop music, makes it on the charts that you hear on the radio. Particularly in country, there's about, there's a handful of stations that control all of these country radio stations. That's why it was so easy to eliminate the Dixie Chicks when, the people who control these radio stations decided that they went against their political stance.
So, and I wanted to add to that there's, many examples that we could cite that are contemporary musicians who are still working along the lines of proclaiming working class issues and rights and other, relevant social justice issues, but they're not played on mainstream radio. So I think that, that's a big part of what our project looks at, is that ownership of the music and then the things that come along with that, the stereotypes and the type of music that is considered country music today that's popular. It's interesting, I think, to look at, some examples that go against, what we're saying about popular country music would be the music of Steve Earle, and he put out a song that lists all of the death row prisoners in Texas, or the music of Uncle Tupelo, where they reclaim a lot of the mining songs and republish them, or some old Woody Guthrie unpublished songs. They put together an album with Billy Bragg of unpublished Woody Guthrie songs. So I think that there is a lot of examples of music that's still very political and speaks to working class issues that are just less played on the radio. And when we look at the recent political elections, We have, you know, Hank Williams Jr. Singing at Sarah Palin's, one of the Republican National Conventions. And then Sarah Palin uses a song by Gretchen Peters called Independence Day. And Gretchen Peters then puts out a message to Sarah Palin that she's not allowed to use her song, and actually has given us permission to use the song, and we plan to interview her as well. So there are a lot of examples of...
Well, tell us a little bit more about her and your relationship. What's and then about the song.
Well, I got in... I became more familiar with Gretchen Peters' music through the whole event of Sarah Palin. I was working on another video project that was sort of debunking the popular thought in media that all women liked and supported Sarah Palin because she was a woman. And so I did a video project where I put a call out to women in our community to come out and speak their minds about the Sarah Palin nomination, and met at a community television station and had all kinds of women come out from the community and talk about how they felt about the nomination, just to provide an alternative look at the statement that, you know, blanketly said all women support Sarah Palin. And during that time, it happened that Sarah Palin used Gretchen Peters' song. So my partner on that project, whose name is Jesse Chabot, and I contacted Gretchen Peters to talk to her about that song. So the song is called Independence Day and is actually a song about domestic violence and about a woman who experiences so much domestic abuse that she puts her house on fire. And it implies that, you know, she and the man are killed, and the daughter then has to, you know, go live in some kind of state housing, a county home. So the chorus of that song is, let freedom ring, let the white dove sing, let the whole world know today is a day of reckoning. Let the weak be strong, let the right be wrong. Roll the stone away, let the guilty pay, it's Independence Day. And so, you know, I mean, that was a song that wasn't played very much on popular radio because Gretchen Peters is a more small-time, probably, you know, performer. And then Sarah Palin picks up the song, and I guess, you know, I think that's a good example of, you know, what commonly happens with country music and the sort of right wing trying to claim it as its voice.
Okay, this is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Today, I'm talking to Jesse Drew, who's a professor of cinema at the University of California at Davis, and also to Glenda Drew, who's an associate professor of design there at UC Davis. And we've been talking about country music and the film that they're working on, which is called Open Country. Jesse, I think you spent some time, in fact, I know this, you spent some time on a Northern California commune. And of course, we had many communes in this part of Northern California, in this part of Mendocino County. In fact, I wanted to put a plug in here. You've written a chapter for a fairly new book called West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California. And I will confess that I'm one of the editors of that book and obviously would recommend it and tell people. I know you can get it at Gallery Books in Mendocino, but probably many other places. But you told me once that your experience in the country, in the deep country, we might say, also has played a part in your interest in music. Right.
Yeah. I think that, you know, when I was a young teenager, you know, I was listening to rock and roll like many of my peers were. And then I kind of hit the road at an early age. I traveled around a lot and I wound up in a lot of places in the countryside in Vermont and in California. And, you know, and so the rock and roll didn't really appealed to me much, and I didn't really speak to what I was sort of experiencing and going through. And so
I had my own sort of revelation about music, I think primarily through the music of Merle Haggard. Actually, I started listening to a lot of early Merle Haggard and was really kind of surprised how much it spoke to me. And I did spend some time on a commune, Black Bear Ranch up in Northern California. And but after that, I sort of drifted away, and I wound up working in a lot of factories. I did a lot of industrial work. And even in those plants, I worked in a large glass bottle factory, for example, and many of my friends were auto workers in the UAW and other factories. And even in that situation, the two, it was, you know, we listened to country music because it spoke really more directly to us in terms of what we were going through. It's just like one of the only music forms that actually acknowledges that you're spending, you know, most of us spend 8 hours a day on a job, often, you know, working for someone else in somewhat unpleasant circumstances. You know, I remember one of the big hits in the automobile industry was Johnny Paycheck's Take This Job and Shove It, and that was like the anthem of auto workers. And, you know, Johnny Paycheck was a big country star at the time, and he really, you know, that song sort of addressed what a lot of people were thinking on assembly lines in the United States at that end. I'm talking about the mid-70s.
Could we continue a bit with this subject? Because mm-hmm. both of you have talked about it. Glenda, you said that your themes in your art, I guess we work, include visualizing the working class and food and labor. What does that mean, visualizing the working class, both in terms of your film, but also in your general work and your outlook, your political outlook?
Well, actually, there's something that I wanted to mention about that in terms of our Open Country project as well, which is that I grew up working class in Chicago, and my father was a truck driver, and one of his favorite songs was 16 Tons, yet he was what I would say, you know, part of, like, racism from below, where, you know, he kind of voted Republican and supported George Bush more than once. Sad to say, but you know, that I think that also that contradiction is something I'm interested in, and visualizing the working class for me has, I don't know, I've worked on a variety of projects around what that means, and I don't consider myself somebody whose talent is in one area. I tend to create projects around ideas, and so the form that the projects take have to do with the content of the ideas. And so you mentioned in my introduction, you know, that I made scratch and sniff trading cards. And so I think that one of the main interests for me is looking at actually kind of xenophobia, maybe also racism, as it is in our society, that it often in terms of class. I think that they're very interconnected. And so I've done several projects looking at immigrant labor, because I think that that's the place that we see a lot of xenophobia and racism. And I think that that's really one of the most important topics of what's happening in the United States. And the kind of, I sometimes, you know, say the war, but that's probably not the right word of, like, what's happening, you know, war here on our, in our territory is all about immigrant labor and trying to build walls to keep people out, and the many things associated with that.
And Jesse, in your work as a filmmaker, is there a class connection, as there is obviously in this film, Open Country?
Well, I think that in all my work there is a class connection, and I think what's important to me is to let me get back to how I even wound up doing media. Like I said, I was, you know, working more in labor movements, and I was always sort of stunned by working alongside of, you know, other workers, primarily Caucasian workers, who just were so cut off from any progressive roots they once might have had. And that's not the case with many other workers who are African-American or Mexican-American, and I always wondered, why is there just no connection there? And so I kind of got involved in media to sort of explore that and to sort of use media to sort of remind, you know, people in that situation that they have a progressive past, that they have something to gain from, you know, reconnecting to that progressive past. And, you know, I look at my own roots. Many of my family grew up, you know, dirt poor in the Bronx and, you know, in Bronx, New York, and would have been in that same situation, except that there's an intellectual culture amongst working class people in many New York neighborhoods. And I think that's really important that white working class people have an intellectual tradition and value, you know, that sort of, you know, the ability to sort of, you know, think on your feet and make these connections beyond just what's right in front of you. So I think that, you know, most of the projects that I engage with are in search of that, trying to make bigger connections, allow people to make bigger connections with just the, you know, the day-to-day of daily life.
I think that says something important I wanted to stress about our project also that we haven't talked enough about yet. And I think that's that, you know, we both really love country music in a more traditional folk form than, you know, current country music that might be played on the radio. And that country music has this beautiful international history of blending of cultures, you know, the influence of the many different instruments, like, you know, the banjo that originated in Africa and the fiddle playing that has strong Celtic influences and the mandolin from Italy, the steel guitar from Hawaii and yodeling from, you know, Swiss influences that blend together and make something that's authentically American. And also in the past was mostly traditional songs that were passed down through oral history, and folk music was something that was decidedly not authored. So they were songs that were passed down generation to generation and changed at will, changed both in terms of the words and the melodies, adjusted and, you know, continued to be contemporary for those who were singing it. And I just think, like for me, it's really important to put those connections back for the, you know, everyone who is a current fan of country music to claim that history that's so rich.
Okay, well, it sounds like a pretty nice life you two have. Lots and lots of fun. But I think you probably have to punch the clock now and again at the university as well. So maybe we could end up with a question just about your work. What are students coming to you looking for, maybe? And what would you like, what kind of a message would you like students to get from you and your work in these very interesting areas?
I'll answer first, if you don't mind. I think that because I teach in design, and many students study design over art because design has a higher possibility of a real paycheck. And I find that my students are often people who begin as interested in art, but, you know, their parents don't want them to study art in college because, you know, it doesn't have a sure career afterwards where design does. And so I find that many of my students are interested in going into advertising, and I just try to always remind them that what they're learning in terms of design and visual language is so powerful, and that they're developing a powerful voice using visual language that they can use for many messages, not just, you know, touting the voice of capitalism, but that they can use those same tools to express a lot of meaningful communication that they, you know, might want to in their future. And I try to take on projects in my classes that have some kind of social or political relevance because certainly there's plenty of advertising opportunities that await my students.
So give us an example, and then we'll go back to Jesse. Same question.
Okay, so in my spring class, I teach an interactive class, and we'll be working with an organization in Oakland called 67 Sueños, and that's an organization of immigrant youth who are trying to expand the legislation of the DREAM Act to be more inclusive. And so that group recently did a mural at the Civic Center in San Francisco, and they would like to create an interactive mural that can have layers of associated meaning, like video interviews with the youth who worked on the mural. And so my students will work with those youth to create an interactive version of their mural that has a deep level of storytelling and with it.
Hmm. And Jesse, what?
Yeah, I think that my work, you know, to a certain extent overlaps somewhat with what Glenda does. And you know, I really like to tell my students that, you know, to, you know, question authority and to, you know, really to value study, to value their intellect for its own sake. I think that a lot of people understand they're coming to the university to learn a job skill, and I don't want to deflect that. I understand that's an important aspect of that, but I think it's also important that they value education for its own sake, because it's going to take them a lot farther in life. And also, you know, I also emphasize, you know, learning media skills to give back to the community as well. I taught a community media class recently, and we worked together with the local food co-op here, and we made a sort of a 10-minute overview of the food co-op that group could use to publicize themselves and to you know, let the community know what they're doing in the community. It was a good way that students got to use their skills to produce something, you know, that's useful for the community.
So professor of cinema means you're not just studying cinema, but you're doing cinema?
Yes. In fact, I would say that's key to what personally I'm interested in. I'm very much an advocate of studies and practice. Yeah, I think that's where knowledge comes from, when you not only study something, but you apply that in the real world.
Okay, well, one last thing. I like to encourage people to find out what's being written these days. And I think, did I mention this, that you are writing, you've written a new book, Social History of Contemporary Democratic Media. We've got a minute left. What's that book about? And when will people be looking for it?
Well, it should be published in May. It's being published by Routledge Press, which is a big academic press based here and in London. And it provides context for the YouTubes and Facebooks of today. A lot of people think that kind of social media sort of dropped out of thin air thanks to, the computer industry and Wall Street and Hollywood. And it really looks at where those forms of social media originate. And so it gives some context going back the last 30, 40 years of many, many other projects that use the same form of media model develop communities using, you know, the electronic tools that were available. So it's a sort of a big overarching contextual view of social media.
So we'll have to stop now. I think there's a lot more that we could talk about. Our program, to remind you, is Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. This morning I've been talking with Jesse Drew and Glenda Drew. They're both professors at the University of California at Davis. And we've mainly been talking about country music and about their film to come, Open Country. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cal.
It's been a great pleasure. And for our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week, so good morning.